This is episode number 5 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, March 22nd, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito. For this episode, we took the podcast on the road. Earlier this week, we held one of our occasional Alcohol Liberation Front happy hours at the Science Club in Washington, D.C. There, Tech Liberation Front contributors and readers got together to discuss tech policy over beers. In this first clip, TLF contributor Jim Harper of the Cato Institute talks to David Robinson of The American Magazine about how scholarly journals are going open source. You'll also hear yours truly's voice in the conversation.
I'm actually working on a piece for our magazine right now about the travails of scholarly publishing. So this is things like archive.org in the physics world, which this guy who solved the Poincaré conjecture and won the Fields Medal, which is the top prize in mathematics, and is a recluse and is strange and declined the award. But anyway, he never published his findings at all. He just posted them on archive. And he won the prize that every mathematician has a lifetime goal of achieving. The point is, meanwhile, journals are seeing dwindling subscription base, and they're in a sort of death spiral of increasing subscriptions. It recently made the news that they've hired an extremely famous, aggressive public relations guy called Eric Desnall. And it's because they really are threatened by the so-called open access movement and the idea that, you know, the money should be going to research rather than to, you know, the publication process itself. And so I don't know how that's going to end up, but I think it's fascinating. I think it's important because it influences the ways that research happens and might influence the speed with which research occurs and the sort of pace of progress.
Do you know anything about this? I heard that Joe Lieberman's got a bill that would make all research that is funded with any federal money have to be published open on the Internet so that they couldn't just give it to a journal that would then charge a subscription fee.
I don't know about the Lieberman bill. I did know that some people thought that that would be a good idea. There are some things that are of that general kind that have to do with NIH that are in place now, that have to do with things that are 2 years old, I think, or older, have to be released publicly. So the journals can still maintain their temporary monopoly for a while. I don't know a lot about it, and I don't have a view about particular legislative mandates. But I think the fact that that's appealing, politically appealing and politically plausible, and that people have to explain why it shouldn't happen if they don't think that it should, is a radical turning of the tables from the tremendous power that the leading journals in scientific fields used to enjoy. And I don't know how it's going to end up, but I very much doubt that the future is going to closely resemble the present.
I see the same thing happening in my parochial field in law review publishing. It used to be that there was one law review per law school, if even that. Then there became multiple law reviews, and so there was lots more publication, lots more access to publication to professors. Now anybody can put something on SSRN.org, the Social Science Research Network, and it's a matter of merit, whether it's viewed many times or downloaded many times. The fact that you're in Harvard Law Review doesn't matter very much anymore. It's whether people care about what you have to say. And I don't even pay any attention anymore to what journal something is in. If it's on SSRN and it's good, I'll go read it and I'll recommend it to others.
And if you don't have a blog with which to promote your SSRN posting, you're nowhere. So a lot of these old professors.
That highlights the importance of influencing the Tech Liberation Front bloggers and making clear to them what you've done and passing it along to the public through us.
I have a question about this SSRN process, and that is, now that you no longer have the authoritative filtration of the Harvard Law Review as what you're using, the question is, how do you figure out which of the hundreds of papers to read?
Well, that's an economic problem that's being solved by peer production, if you will. And we had at Cato, we had a paper that we published last year on all the different steps in the content publication process. One of them is selection, article selection. And it's being done on SSRN, where they note the number of summary views and the number of downloads, for example. So if you see a high number, like, okay, this is popular, this is important. But the other way is independently through the blogs that you read. Are you being told about this thing? Is somebody saying it's good? And so you get this through this non-hierarchical filtration system that you develop for yourself. I blogged about a paper today that I read about on Bruce Schneier's blog. He's a security expert that I think is a great thinker. The fact that he blogged it meant that I should be interested in it. I was, and I wrote about it further, hopefully extending the audience yet further.
All right, David Robinson, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you.
In this next clip, TLF contributors Tim Lee and PJ Dolan talk about the growing scope of patents.
I think the real issue isn't so much a question of whether or not these journal articles should be open source. The real question is, to what extent has the patent system enabled scientific fact to be something that falls under the scope of patent protection? Right now you have doctors who are managing to patent findings about relationships between the results of medical tests and diagnoses. And now you have clinicians being shaken down for a royalty check for performing a routine blood test to figure out if somebody has something. If we had better protection for the republishing of fact, this wouldn't be quite as much of an issue.
So, Tim Lee, what do you think about that?
I agree with that, and I think a similar point can be made about software patents, which in many cases are patents on a broad category of procedures that you can do with data, like sending an email over a wireless network or buying things with one click, where it's not so much a specific invention as a broad category of activities you can engage in. And I really think that the idea of patents originally was to cover specific inventions, and it's not clear to me that a lot of these things that we're talking about really count as inventions in a sense that the patent law should recognize.
So how did patents get broadened the way that they have, to that they now include things like what you guys would consider facts?
Well, I think the standard story is that the big change was that in the 1980s, Congress created a special court, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, that was dedicated entirely to the patent system. Not entirely, but all patent cases went to the Federal Circuit. And the result was that all the judges, or most of the judges in the Federal Circuit, were former patent attorneys that thought software patents were great and patents in general were great and didn't see why we shouldn't apply patents to absolutely everything. And so you have a sort of regulatory capture story where the people who are benefiting from the patent system are in a position to increase the scope of the patent system, thereby further enriching themselves and their friends and colleagues in the patent bar.
So why doesn't the obviousness standard serve as a filter for things like email over a wireless network?
Well, I think there's two aspects to that. One is that the obviousness standard itself has just been so diluted. This is what the Telefux place is looking at. You had the idea of connecting a gas pedal to an electronic throttle, which you would not think was a particularly mind-blowing idea, but because you couldn't find prior art for it, they said, well, that's not obvious. The other aspect of it was that the Supreme Court had a doctrine that facts of nature and mathematical algorithms were not eligible for patent protection. And what the Federal Circuit did over the course of 20 years was nitpick to that point where it's still technically true, but, for example, in the software context, you can't patent a program, but you can patent a computer performing the program, which is not clear what the difference is, but the Federal Circuit nitpicks it to the point where effectively you can patent software as long as you sort of have the right magic incantation at the beginning of the patent to have the result that you want.
Now TLF contributor James Gattuso of the Heritage Foundation tells us about the federal government's plan to make sure everyone keeps getting television after the digital transition by ensuring a chicken in every pot and a digital converter in every garage.
February of 2009, what's going to happen?
What happens is all broadcasting on the current analog frequencies will be discontinued, and it will instead be continued only on the new digital stations, which means that if you do not have digital television or cable or satellite subscriptions, your TV will not work. It'll work if you want to put a VCR, DVDs and things like that, but it would not be able to pick up over-the-air broadcasting. You need to have a converter box in order to do that.
And so what's the government doing about this?
Well, it's going to buy you converter boxes. The Department of Commerce is putting together a program where, as mandated by Congress, to provide up to two coupons worth $40 each towards the purchase of a converter box, a purchase of two converter boxes for your home. Under their latest decision, that includes not just the people that otherwise would not have television reception, but would even cover people who have cable television subscriptions.
So Bill Gates would get a converter coupon.
Bill Gates could get two converter coupons. Now the thing with the cable subscriptions is if you have cable, you don't need a converter box for your cable television. You already have a box, the cable company provides a box or whatever.
So what's the harm? I mean, people who have cable probably aren't going to go out and go through the trouble of getting a coupon, right?
They may. In fact, they probably will, because most people who have a couple of TVs hooked up to cable also have one in the basement and one in the kitchen. I know I do. We have a 30-year-old television in the kitchen we use. It's a black and white set, works off of rabbit ears. A 20-year-old set in the basement that we rarely use. But if the government offers to buy us converter boxes for those, yeah, we'll probably take it.
Well, don't you have a right to over-the-air television?
No, I don't think I have a right to television. a lot of people do look at that. I shouldn't laugh at the concept. A lot of people look at this and say, well, the government's turning off my television, so they've done me harm. They've wronged me, so they should make up for it. But the point is, you don't have that television license. The television license is held by the broadcaster, and they could turn that off whenever they wanted, frankly. There's no obligation for them to continue and to keep that license. The broadcasters want this transition. They negotiated a deal with the federal government 10 years ago for them to get an additional set of quite valuable spectrum while they eased out of the old spectrum. So this was a trade that the broadcasters agreed to. And now, 10 years later, they're finally about to fulfill their end of the deal.
So here's my idea, though. I probably can't use all the coupons, so what I'm thinking is getting the coupon, getting a converter box, and then auctioning it off on eBay to Canadians across the border who, you know, most of the Canadian population lives on the border. They get American TV signals, but of course they're not eligible for the program, so maybe I can sell to them.
Well, that's right. They do need converter boxes. It's like the immigration issue. There's a lot of Canadians there who are watching television that Americans are unable or unwilling to watch.
Right. So we would get their, if everything goes right, we'll get their price-controlled drugs, and they can get our free converter boxes.
Well, it would be a nice deal. We get their cheap drugs, and we give them our cheap television.
Finally, Tech Liberation contributor Adam Thierer of PFF talks with PJ Dolan, Tim Lee, and yours truly about the future of physical media in a digital age.
After I went to a CES show about is physical media dead, and the argument was, will physical media, like plastic, vinyl, whatever, does any of that have a future? And people were very divided about it, but as you can imagine, the people who made physical media said, absolutely, it's going to thrive forever. But there was a good point that was made about people love to have something that actually can be put on a shelf, that they can look at the back of. It's like, they want to kick the tires of physical media. And geeks like us, who love our electronica, we don't mind having all intangible digital bits of stuff stored on some giant mega server in our attics. But the rest of the people in America, not necessarily the same as us.
There's an age divide, though. I go to visit my sister, on campus at a local university. Nobody has CDs. I couldn't. The only CDs that you see are ones that people have bought while they've been there, and then when they go home, they take them home, and you don't see them the next year when they show up the next year. Everything's on their computer.
I agree. It could be a generational thing, and it could be that in another 10 years, basically, a huge percentage of people have gone all intangible. Everything's on servers, on their computers, whatever. I don't know if it means that physical media is entirely dead, though. And I don't know if HD DVD or Blu-ray will prevail. But there could be a hybrid format. And already, there's a company that has developed a single format that has both HD DVD on one side, Blu-ray on the other. And now there's already hybrid players. LG makes a player now that's out on the market that'll play both formats. So it could be you have the best of both worlds, where you do have physical formats for those who want them. You also have the purely intangible, downloadable stuff for geeks like us.
The other thing, though, is that there is no video equivalent to the iPod. I mean, the part of the problem is the video tools for non-physical media all suck, and so it's not surprising the consumers haven't gotten excited about them. I think if you had, a really good, cheap video jukebox, you'd have a lot more enthusiasm for that.
But nobody wants to watch video on a little 3-inch screen. They want to watch it on a bigger screen. And that's where Apple TV comes in. What do you think about that, PJ?
I think it's interesting the approach that Apple took with making sure that the storage is not actually on the physical device and having a very small drive in there. In one sense, they might be trying to steer customers away from an ownership model, and that may have been the primary reason they were doing that.
Last word, Adam.
I got no comment on that one. I hate Apple. That's all I know.
That's a good last comment.
That wraps it up for this edition of Tech Policy Weekly. To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, and please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. Goodbye.
My name is Tom Pearson. I have a large beard. Grizzly Adams did have a beard, and I just want to say Tech Policy Weekly kicks ass.